I'd like now to welcome Richard Wolff. He is a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School University in New York. His radio program, Economic Update, airs Sundays at 5 o'clock here on KSFR. And he will be giving the keynote speech at the upcoming symposium, Banking on New Mexico. That's Saturday, September 27th at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your invitation.
So you have taken a very hard look at capitalism on behalf of the rest of us who are out here struggling in the world, and many of us read Karl Marx and other critiques of capitalism in college or grad school. I did at St. John's here in Santa Fe. And the takeaway for many of us, at least for me, was that the various critiques of capitalism are dead accurate, whether it's about 1848 or the present. Namely, with capitalism, we have horrific inequality, poverty, boom-bust cycles, and then a brutal assault on nature and all the environmental crises we're having now. But we seem to have a hard time as a society finding alternatives that are kinder to people and the earth. We've got the critique. What do you think are the stronger alternatives?
Well, that's a great question. And I think to start out, I think that we should admit, those of us that are critics of capitalism, that it's a mixed bag what has been tried so far as an alternative, in the sense that whether you look at Russia or China or Cuba and those other people who have tried, they hit a lot of snags along the way, and the outcomes there had some things that were certainly praiseworthy, but they had a good bit of things that we would not want in a future that was decent to human beings. And so I think we have to learn from the mistakes. It isn't unusual, I might add, in the history of the human race, when we shifted from slavery to non-slavery or from feudalism to capitalism 400 or 500 years ago, the early efforts to make those transitions often ended badly. So it isn't all that surprising that the early efforts to go beyond capitalism have, as I say, a mixed record. But in any case, having learned from that, here is what I would suggest. Instead of thinking, as we have been used to do for the last 100 years, of alternatives to capitalism as being social ownership of the means of production rather than private ownership, in other words, government enterprises run and operated by the government, owned by the government, versus private. And instead of thinking of socialism that way, and instead of thinking of socialism as an alternative to capitalism because it substitutes government planning instead of the market, I think the focus ought to be on a completely different level of economic life, not at the high levels of who owns what and whether the market is arranging for the distribution of resources and products or planners are doing it. My focus and everything that I do is to focus on how we organize the actual enterprise. You might say it's the ground level approach. It's the approach at the bottom. How do we organize the factories, the stores, the offices, where all the work gets done, where the goods and services we all depend on get produced? And I think there lies both the secret to why capitalism is no longer serving the needs of most people, and to where at least we can be pointed in finding an alternative. And the simplest way to summarize it is this. In a typical capitalist enterprise, a corporation as we know it, basically a tiny group of people sit at the top, and they have all the power and make all the decisions. The group has two parts. The major shareholders, that is the folks who own big blocks of shares, and the board of directors. And the way a corporation works is the board of directors, usually 15, 20 people, are selected by a vote of the shareholders. So that if you own no shares of a company, you have no votes. If your grandmother left you 10 shares, you have 10 votes. But if you're a wealthy family or a big bank, then of course you dispose of hundreds of thousands or millions of votes for all the shares that you own. So in effect, the small group, 10, 20 people, who own the block of shares select the board of directors, another group of 15 or so folks, and that tiny number, 25 more or less, 30 maybe, they have all the power. They decide what an enterprise produces. They decide how the enterprise produces. They decide where the enterprise will be located. And perhaps most important, they decide what to do with the profits that the enterprise generates. The vast mass of people affected by what that corporation does, the workers who can often number, as in big American companies, hundreds of thousands. Walmart in America, our largest employer, has over 1 million employees, etc. But the decisions that they have to live with, literally, whether they have a job, what kind of income they earn, what prospects for advancement they might enjoy, all of those decisions are made by a tiny group of folks at the top of this pyramid, and the mass of working people have no control, no say, no vote, no anything to control what happened. Well, you know, I'm an American born and bred here and lived all my life here, and I was taught 800 times that democracy means if you're affected by a decision, then you have the right to participate in making that decision, that it is undemocratic and unacceptable to be at the receiving end of decisions over which you have no effective power or control. And here's the punchline. The typical capitalist enterprise is therefore a case study in the absence of democracy because it does not allow the mass of people any real say. So if a company decides to leave the United States and move instead its production facilities to China, as hundreds and hundreds of companies, large and small, have done in the United States in recent years, that decision is made at the top by that tiny number of people, and the vast mass of people are affected because they lose their jobs disappear on them. And the same applies, for example, if a technology is chosen that pollutes the air or the water around the office or the factory, that endangers the health of the people who work there. These decisions are made, again, usually in the interest of profits, by that tiny group at the top. And so the alternative kind of speaks for itself. The alternative is we ought to run our enterprises in a democratic way. We ought to extend the democracy we say as a nation we believe in to the workplace, so that all the workers there, the bosses, the secretaries, the technicians, the factory workers, the you name it, all have a democratic, one person, one vote, say in those crucial decisions what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. You know, at the annual dinner of many corporations, it is not unusual for the chief executive to stand up and thank all of the workers in the factory for their hard work in producing the wonderful results we've had. Our profit has gone up 10% or whatever. And I've always found it ironic that here is the folks at the top recognizing that everybody helped to produce the profits, but rigidly keeping in their own hands the decision of what to do with what they admit everybody had a share in producing. And I think if we change, if we make a transition in the United States from an economy that is very undemocratic at its core, where the goods and services are produced, into one that is democratic, and here I can use the old tradition because there's a long history in America of being interested in this. It's called the co-op movement or the cooperative movement. Workers in America and other countries, too, have long tried to develop enterprises that really run in a different democratic way. And the bottom line is, I think if you want an economy to serve the people, then you have to put the people in charge. You cannot be surprised, as so many Americans seem to be, when the folks who run the corporations at the top turn out to make decisions that are very good for them as shareholders playing the stock market, that are good for them as boards of directors taking home those stupendous executive salaries we read about all the time, and leaving the vast mass of us to struggle, as you put it at the beginning. That's not a very surprising outcome, and if you want to really deal with that, then you've got to change the way enterprises are organized, and that is the solution I think we need to look at.
So the model you're talking about is large corporations, publicly traded corporations with the boards of directors and the shareholders. What, in your thinking, is the role of the entrepreneur? I mean, every big company was once an idea in some dude's head, right? So let's say you get an idea, you start a business, you hire an employee, you hire two employees. At what point does it become a worker-owned cooperative? What if that's not what you want? What if that's not what works best?
Right. Well, we have actually quite a good set of empirical indicators. In other words, that question has been variously answered by a variety of actual efforts by existing cooperative enterprises, because they didn't want to lose innovation. They didn't want to lose whatever genius this or that man or woman has to come up with a new product or a new way of doing things and so forth. And they have tried a variety. I'll give you some examples. One system says, well, if you start an enterprise and it is successful, then the society, in order to encourage this sort of thing, gives you a special payoff, a kind of increase in your wealth or your income as a reward for your having done that. And for example, one of the ways to do that is to say that, yes, it'll be a cooperative at a certain point, but a portion of the profits of that cooperative for 5 years, for 10 years, and so forth, will be allocated to the individual who started it all in recognition of his or her creativity. In this way, you're doing something inside a co-op that is not so different from what we call patent law in capitalism. In other words, the ability, if you register a new technique or a new product, you can get protection for a certain number of years. It's actually 17 under the most patent laws in this country anyway. For 17 years, you get the exclusive right to make that thing, and therefore, of course, you can charge wild prices because nobody can enter to compete with you. But then at a certain point, it's understood this becomes socially undesirable, because by preventing other competitors, you're also preventing other creative people who could come in and do this sort of thing, perhaps in ways better than you, and certainly at a lower price with competition than without it. So the compromise made in capitalism was to give people a patent protection, but only for a limited number of years. Something perfectly comparable could be done and has been done in some co-ops who take a portion of the profits to reward innovations of various kinds, both by the person who starts an enterprise, but also for people along the way who come up with important breakthroughs that made the enterprise more efficient or able to produce at a lower price, etc. Another example, co-ops have been known to identify along the way people with extraordinary mechanical abilities or just wonderful imaginations of how to do things better. And what they've decided to do is to maintain the cooperative structure of the enterprise because of all the virtues and values it has, but recognize that there are some people who make breakthroughs, and their reward is basically to be given the facilities, basically time off, sometimes a whole lifetime off, from regular work to go to work in a workshop or a laboratory where they can be maximally useful doing something other than the same work everybody else does, namely doing stuff to invent new ways if they've shown an aptitude for that. The most famous co-op in the world right now is the something called the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation in Spain. And its history is so remarkable that it answers a lot of these questions because it provides concrete examples of what they did in this situation, how they handled innovation. And so we can see from what worked for them, what didn't work for them, how we might do it. I might mention that Mondragon has a whole side of a hill. I visited there, whole side of a hill devoted to its laboratories, where it provides the facilities and the support for people who are part of the Mondragon Corporation, have been selected, however they did that, to be basically what you might call a cooperative R&D department, research and development. And they're very, very good at it, so good that not only did the Mondragon Corporation grow over the last 50 years, it started as a little co-op with six people. It now employs over 100,000 people. It's the seventh largest corporation in all of Spain, a state of co-op all the way through. And there are two American companies that are so taken with their labs, the way they've set them up cooperatively, that they have bought the right to have their own scientists work alongside the Mondragon scientists in the labs over there because they are so taken with the quality of what they do. And I don't mind mentioning the names of the two American corporations. One is General Motors and the other one is Microsoft. And I think that shows you that they've been able to manage that problem pretty well.
Very interesting. We're talking to Richard Wolf in advance of the Banking on New Mexico Symposium, which is coming up next weekend. You know, you were talking at the beginning about how you are taking a ground-level approach to economics. And, I mean, all economies at their base take things from the earth, take things from the water, farming, mining, whatever. You sell them or you make them into something else and you sell them. And first, next thing you know, you've got things like derivatives and dividends and stock markets and financial structures that benefit a very small percentage of people but seem very far removed from the foundation on which they are built. But what happens when we overexploit the land and water that are at their root? Let's say we kill the oceans, we destroy the soil, we use up the minerals in the ground. Does the whole edifice come tumbling down, or has that top layer somehow developed this like survival ability?
Yes, it's wonderful. Wonderful how you put that. Well, let's see. Let's unpack it a little bit and take a look. First, in the United States, there's a word called competition, which has a certain holy halo or aura around it, that it is supposed to be, I don't know, like apple pie, motherhood, and baseball, something that is so generally wonderful that to speak ill of it suggests that you're crazy or something else. But I'm an economist, I've done this all my life, and I have to tell you, although I hope it comes as no great surprise, that competition, like everything else, has its good sides, but it also has its bad sides. And ecology teaches us one of its horrific sides. And here's how that works. If you're a businessman or woman, you run an enterprise of one kind or another, you're always under pressure to maximize your profits. And that's not because you're a greedy person, although you may well be, but it's because the more profits you have, the more likely you are to survive. Because you're always worried that a competitor, someone else who produces what you do, may uncover a new machine that makes his output more efficient than yours, or come up with a new source of raw materials, or cut a new deal with some outlet to whom he sells. And in order to compete and survive, you have to have the most profit possible in your hands to buy an equivalent machine, to come up with a new strategy to cope with your competitors' innovations, etc., etc. And so you're always forced to push for more profits. And one of the ways that a company does that is it tries to grow. It tries to be able to sell, produce and sell more goods, hire more workers, because the more you produce and sell, the more workers you have working for you, other things equal, the more profit you'll have. So if you're going to have more maximum profit to survive, then economic growth, getting bigger and bigger, is kind of built in to how you stay a surviving, let alone a successful business. Okay, this is the way it looks to every individual capitalist. So they all end up doing pretty much the same thing, growing as fast as they can possibly do it, and therefore using up the available working population, but also using up the earth, pulling more and more minerals out of the ground and metals out of the ground and fish out of the ocean and you name it. And that leads to two fundamental difficulties that capitalism has always had. Difficulty number one is if every capitalist is growing because that's how he or she thinks that they can survive, it's not at all surprising that periodically more is produced by all the collection of competitors than the market will bear. And they suddenly discover what we call in economics overproduction or underconsumption. Fancy words that simply say, oh boy, the capitalists in their competition, having all tried to grow, all managed it, and now they have a new problem, more stuff than they can sell at a profitable price. And then we know what happens. The business cycle turns down. We have crashes. If they're bad, they're like the one we're in now, they are deep and last a long time. The other problem that this competition produces is the one you allude to, namely, you use up the environment, the natural environment, without any time or effort devoted to anything respectful of that environment, to renewing resources that you're taking away, to developing new resources, to developing technologies that are specifically designed to save the environment, to save the parkland, whatever it is. No capitalist in our system has time or interest in doing that. If you actually go to capitalists, which I've done many times, and talk about ways that they in their business could be more environmentally careful, they look at you and they say, look, I agree with you, and there's not an argument about the principle, but they also say to you, I can't do that. If I did what you just recommended to me, and which I can see would be good for the environment, I will be out of business, and my competitors, who are less committed to this, will be laughing all the way to the bank, collecting my money, and I'm sorry, sir, but I'm not going to self-destruct. Let me give you a very concrete example that affects every person listening to this program. 40 years ago, and ever since, a large number of American corporations decided that they didn't like paying the high wages that created the American middle class, and that they could make much more money by moving production out of the United States to Mexico, to Latin America, later on to China, India, Brazil, and all the rest. It's all well known now. And so they did that in order to make more money. And as soon as the first capitalist thought of it and did it, and was able to go to China where he can pay someone, you know, a dollar an hour instead of paying an American, you know, $20 an hour or whatever the comparison then was, and it was of that order of magnitude, the minute the first capitalist did that, every other capitalist who was competing with that first one had to basically follow suit or risk being competed out of existence. And so we've had the vast movement. Okay, now let's look at that. That was necessary for every capitalist who wanted to survive. They all had to move production to China. Okay, that was very profitable, but it had one small problem. The goods are now produced in China, but the Americans who are the market for it are still back home. That required an unbelievable new development in the world. The massive shipping and transport of goods that used to be produced in the United States near their market, that now had to be shipped from literally the other side of the world to reach the American market, and therefore required vast use of freight ships which burn fossil fuel at a rate that pollutes the air, freight ships that drop overboard into the ocean, God knows what kinds of toxic materials. And we have done a major job of befouling our environment in ways we all bemoan now. But if you look a little closer, you'll see that it comes out of the nature of the way capitalism is organized that is at the root of so much of this. And so it becomes difficult for folks like me to understand how and why even good people concerned about the environment shy away from looking at how the economic system that we have is a major cause of this dilemma.
So, I mean, the liberal Democrat response to that is that, okay, you have strong environmental regulations, you have fair wages, you have freedom to organize, you have tariffs and protectionism of some kind. If you're on one end of it, you have agreements that incentivize factories or whatever, production staying in the United States. Is that a good argument?
Well, you know, it would be difficult to answer such an argument if they had any serious evidence that these kinds of effective controls have really ever worked in the United States, or at least in the modern United States. They don't. What we have is a series of more or less half-hearted measures. Not infrequently, liberal Democrats put them up there. As they work their way through Congress, all of the interests that don't want to see them, the business interests, go to work with their favorite senators or representatives. And this basically exists on both parties, so there's no point haggling over which one is better or worse. And by the time the bill is done and it goes to the president's desk and he signs it, it has been so watered down, it has been so pockmarked with exemptions and special circumstances and modes of evasion that the industries often applaud the bill when it finally comes through, because it is so namby-pamby, it is so riddled with holes, that their hope is everyone will think, oh, good, we have a bill that puts limits or constrains all these bad things, and now we don't have to worry about it the way we did in the past. And then lo and behold, 2, 3, 4 years later, or maybe when some catastrophe like the Valdez up in Alaska or the Horizon down in the Gulf of Mexico brings it back to everybody's attention, and then we realize, oh, goodness, that bill that we vaguely remember 3 years ago that was supposed to take care of this doesn't. It doesn't work. And in the example I gave you before, you know, most of the major department stores, whether you go from Target and Walmart at one end to the smaller and higher end type of stores at the other, they are all now basically dependent on clothing, for example, appliances also, from China, India, Brazil, very, very far away. And those they can price at a price that allows an already squeezed American middle class to make at least some purchases. They do not want rules that will make it either impossible or more costly to ship all that stuff produced so far away to the American stores that they operate. And their influence, to be as polite about this as I can, their influence is prodigious, is enormous. And until we deal with that, the efforts of well-meaning folks mobilizing, as we are going to have here in New York in a few days, huge demonstration, they expect now hundreds of thousands of people, about climate change and all of that. But even with that, it looks as though when it comes to the bills being written, the people who are mainly businesses who have a lot to lose if this happens, tend to prevail.
Well, I was sort of more thinking about the kind of century-long big picture in which we did kind of abolish child labor, at least on our land, and we've got, you know, the EPA and things like that. I mean, not right now, but in certain periods of our history, it has been able to pass actually sweeping, effective laws. And I guess the question is, in theory, does that help, or are we just basically kind of mitigating this creeping capitalism, which still eats up the ground and the lives of ordinary people?
No, I think the question is spot on. I mean, historically, here's how it works. You're absolutely right. Periodically, when masses of people have had enough, when something happens in the collective consciousness of entire people, they kind of, and I don't want to overdo these metaphors, but they kind of wake up and they look around and they kind of see for the first time what was always there, but what they had not perhaps wanted to see or felt confident enough to see or didn't see enough folks around them seeing it that way too. Whatever it was, that is overcome, and then you have a surge of demand for something decent, like child labor laws, like limiting the length of the working day to a basic 8 hours. There are many examples of that. The ones I like most, because it's so dramatic now, is the period of the Great Depression in the 1930s in the United States. That was an economic downturn worse than the one we're in now, considerably worse, at least so far. It meant that there were many more people, percentage-wise, out of work. It meant that every level of government in the United States, local, state, and federal, had no money because nobody was paying taxes because they were unemployed and the businesses were cutting back, etc. Did they then have a massive cutback of what the government could do for people, given that the government had no money and given that people were unemployed? And the ironic answer, which shocks so many Americans today, is no. The government of the United States in the 1930s did an astounding increase in services for the mass of people. Just to remind everyone, it was in the depths of the Depression, when there was no money to do anything, according to the usual wisdom, the mass of Americans did two things. One, they joined labor unions. Millions of them did. People who had never been in a union before, whose parents had never had anything to do with unions, millions of them joined a union because they thought that being in a union would get them through this awful depression with less suffering than if they weren't in one. It was the greatest surge of unionization in American history. We've never had anything like it before, and we've never had anything like it since. The second thing Americans did in extraordinary numbers, we're talking hundreds of thousands, they joined two socialist and one communist party. The socialist parties, the communist party, and the unions all worked together and created a massive organized political force from below. They went to Roosevelt and they said, the president at that time, they said, look, we represent quite a few millions of voters, and we're here to tell you, Mr. President, that you have got to do something for the suffering of the mass of the people. Remember, it was a much worse depression than the one we've been through the last 5 years. You've got to do something, because if you don't, there's going to be a revolution here. And then the people who have all the money won't have anything. So we suggest you go talk to the rich people and the corporations, and you say to them what we just told you, and give them the choice. They can come up with the money to pay for really taking care of the mass of Americans in a way we've never had before, or, and then their voices trailed off because the or can't be spoken. So,
what do you mean can't be spoken? Like armed revolution?
Yeah, it scares people. If it isn't a revolution about your clothing or your diet, if it's a revolution about the society, it's hard to speak about it, especially the last 50 years. And it's always a bit of a vague concept because you don't know exactly what you're getting into when you do that kind of thing. Anyway, the important part of the story is Roosevelt goes back to the wealthy and the corporations, tells them pretty much what he was told, and advocates that they don't make the mistake of thinking this is a bluff. And he persuades about half of the folks that he approached, wealthy folks like himself, business leaders. And he said, okay, now that means you're going to have to pay for it. And that's what he did. In 1933 and 4, the taxes on corporations and the rich were lifted to way, way higher than they are, for example, today. And the money was raised by the government from the rich. And here's what they did with it. Number one, they created the Social Security system. Every person over 65 would get a check for the rest of their lives every month in recognition of the lifetime of work and service that they had provided to the larger community. Number two, he created the unemployment compensation system. If you're unemployed and it's no fault of your own, that is, you didn't do something wrong, you get an unemployment check every week for a couple of years to cushion the whole experience for you. Number three, he passed the first minimum wage that we've ever had in the United States. And by the way, we never had a Social Security system before. We never had unemployment compensation before. And finally, the biggest one, he announces, he makes a statement roughly using these words. If the private sector cannot provide jobs for the millions of Americans who ask for nothing other than a chance to work, then there's no alternative but for the government to do it, and that's what I'm going to do, he said. And he was good to his word. In the period from 1934 to 1941, the federal government created and filled roughly 15 million jobs. Now, this cost an enormous amount of money. Social Security did, unemployment did, and the government employment program obviously did. Where did the money come from? Taxing corporations and the rich was a major part of where the money came from. The very thing that today is kind of a common wisdom, oh, well, you could never do that, was precisely what the United States did. But it took an enormous pressure from below, an enormous organization from below, to disrupt the normal way capitalism works and introduce a radical discontinuity in American history. A footnote. Even though people then said, and people now say, that any politician who dared to say such a thing, let alone do it, would be ending his own political career, history teaches us the exact opposite. Franklin Roosevelt became so popular as a result of what I just described that he was reelected to the presidency of the United States four times. No other president in the history of the United States since George Washington had ever achieved anything like that. The notion that if you tax the rich and you actually do things for the mass of people, whether it be prevent child labor, whether it be to provide Social Security or a job when people need it, the notion that if you did this, you can't survive politically is simply contradicted flat out by our own history, even if it's a history with which so many Americans are unfamiliar. But to go right to the nub of your question, it takes an enormous amount of work. It's a very hard struggle to mobilize people into a union, into a political party, into an effective alliance. It's very hard. People often don't have the time, the energy, the stomach, whatever it is, the inspiration to do it. So it doesn't happen very often. When you can get it done, yes, you're quite right. You can do almost anything, whether it's child labor or Social Security or a guaranteed job for people. But here's the problem. The business community, that half of it that Franklin Roosevelt never persuaded, that half of the wealthy in America who didn't like any of this, they will, because that's the way our country works, they will go to work literally from the day you succeed to undo what you have done. And the last 50 years of the United States, in terms of economic history, can be summed up by the following phrase, the undoing of the New Deal, taking away most of the protections, most of the benefits. You know, George Bush even tried to end Social Security. That didn't work. Not that it isn't going to be tried again. But pretty much many of the benefits have been eliminated. Many more have been reduced. And why? Well, here we go back to the capitalist system. Wealthy people and the folks who sit at the top of American corporations have every incentive to remove, whether it's the high taxes that Roosevelt levied on them, whether it's the restrictions that the government placed on what they could or couldn't do, because those interfere in maximizing profit. It's the same logic that makes companies now not want to spend the extra money to clean their smokestacks or to filter their bad materials so they don't go in the groundwater, whatever it may be. They have every incentive. But because a tiny group at the top have the incentive to skirt around or to undo whatever the people demand, the problem is they also have the resources. They are the ones who gather the profits into their own hands. So they have the wealth with which to realize the incentives to undo what the people can force on them periodically by enormous exertions of effort. My proposal to move from an economy organized in this undemocratic way with these tiny groups at the top and shift to a co-op is precisely because then the profits will be in the hands of everybody. It will not be the same kind of divisive society in which the interests of those who get the profits diverging from those who make the goods and services leads to the subordination of the latter in favor of the former. You overcome this if you make people directly, not only the workers where they are at the workplace, but also the people who decide, make the decisions, and therefore run the society.
We're talking to Richard Wolff. I guess, I mean, what you're talking about is still making me think. I mean, we're here in New Mexico. We're in Indian country. We're in a place where people came from Spain and did subsistence farming with acequias. And before that, they were growing corn, squash, and beans in a totally subsistence way. And, I mean, there was, in those systems, no capital, no wealth that was built up in the way that we have capitalism now. And I mean, it seems like capitalists are very good, for better or for worse. I mean, most of us don't want to live in a subsistence way at making wealth, at creating wealth. I mean, these people you were talking about in the Roosevelt era had made wealth out of just the land, the water, the things around them. And, I mean, we still have this question of whether that is sustainable, whether there is an economy that is based on the exploitation of the land and the accumulation of capital, even with worker cooperatives, that can work in a sustainable way.
Right. But again, I think history gives us the way to deal with this. The feudal, the kind of economic system that existed in Europe from roughly 500 AD to 1500 AD, we call it feudalism, Dark Ages, Medieval Ages, Middle Ages, so forth. That was a time in which people told themselves pretty much what you just did. They said, look, before us, there was lots of chaos, there's lots of suffering, and not much economic development. Look at the unspeakable wealth we have accumulated. By the way, wealth that is still so charming and so overwhelming that tourists from America flock to Italy and France and look at these spectacular cathedrals. They were all built in the Middle Ages. Look at these fantastic chateaus. Most of them were built in the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages could say to themselves and the world, we have developed civilization further than anyone else ever did before. By comparison to what we have accomplished, road systems, cities, these beautiful buildings that I described and so on. Everything else is a backward economic alternative, so you shouldn't think about any alternatives. We're the best there ever was. Well, you know, there was its truth to that. They had achieved levels of economic production and organization that were, on some measurements, more advanced than what had existed before. But the problem is, you know, you can't spend your life congratulating yourself on the fact that you're ahead of where your grandmother was, because your grandmother is now gone and you're living your life. Feudalism didn't pay too much attention, as it should have, to the problems inside itself. It was so busy congratulating itself on having advanced compared to what went before that eventually the contradictions, the tensions, the impossibilities of their own system brought them crashing down. I think exactly the same thing is happening now to capitalism. Absolutely, you're right. Capitalism, and by the way, the critics of capitalism have always, or at least most of them, understood and admitted this. Capitalism is remarkably good at technological invention. And that very competition we talked about before is a kind of whip. It's got the carrot and the stick. You make a lot of money if you make a breakthrough, and you are badly punished if your competitor does and you can't follow suit. And the end result of that situation is a kind of technical dynamism that capitalism has rightly pointed to as one of its key virtues. But if you keep focusing on that and you do not look at the internal struggles and differences and conflicts, they will overwhelm you. And I would give as an example now, yes, we have a very technologically advanced capitalism, but the benefits, the wealth that that has generated has been collecting more and more in the hands of a smaller and smaller, tiny minority, as every statistic worth its name shows over the last 40 years. And I am quite clear that no matter how productive our capitalism is, it cannot and it will not survive a situation where the mass of people looking, as they nowadays can with the mass media, looking clearly through the windows of the big house up on the hill, have to confront the growing gap between them and anything they can achieve and what they can see through that window. That's not going to enable this system to survive, no matter how technologically advanced it is. And last point, when capitalism overthrew feudalism, which is what happened, that's what the French Revolution was about, for example, it tried very hard and with considerable success to continue to build on, to capture the technical advances that feudalism had made before it. That is, it didn't want to start, you know, from zero. It wanted to build on what had been done. And it's clear to me that the next phase of human history, whatever the next economic system is, will make a comparable effort to capture and hold on to the technical advances that were achieved by capitalism. But it will also be attentive, in a way capitalism has never been, to the enormous costs of capitalism's system. The cost in lives that could never be realized, you know, all the people who don't have enough wealth to have a proper education, to give a chance for their talents to shine, to give a chance for the rest of us to enjoy the technical breakthroughs they could have achieved if only they had gotten the kind of education we ought to have provided them, but our system doesn't. I think you'll get a sane, balanced appreciation for capitalism's gains, its benefits, its virtues, and its weaknesses, because the next phase of society will want to do that in order to build itself up just the way capitalism did with feudalism before.
Richard Wolff is a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. And his radio program, Economic Update, airs here on KSFR on Sundays at 5 o'clock. We didn't even talk about the banking symposium, which is why we're on the air. But anyway, you will be giving, Richard Wolff, the keynote speech and talking at the upcoming symposium, Banking on New Mexico, which is Saturday the 27th of September. It's an all-day event. Should be lots of fun. For more information, people can go to bankingonnewmexico.org. Richard Wolff, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure, and I look forward to meeting folks in Santa Fe the coming weekend.
Excellent.